Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It is Friday, July 24th, 2020. Every week, we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news on books and publishing. And once again, Andrew Albanese, PW senior writer, joins me from his home office. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So his poll numbers with voters may be down. Donald J. Trump is a landslide winner, nevertheless, with publishers and readers, Andrew. As PW reported this week, recent books about the president are powering strong overall industry sales.
Yeah, it's sort of like it's shades of 2018, right? When we had Trump-related books by Michael Wolff and Bob Woodward and James Comey also powering industry sales. Last week, the industry was led by huge sales of Mary L. Trump's memoir, Too Much and Never Enough, with unit sales of print books overall for the industry up a stout 11.5% last week at outlets that report to NPD BookScan. Publisher Simon & Schuster reports that Mary Trump's book has sold a total of more than 1.35 million copies across all formats, including pre-orders. That's sales of print books, e-books, audiobooks. And Simon & Schuster has gone back to press now for a 17th printing. That success has led to a solid 13.9% gain in unit sales in the adult nonfiction segment over the week that ended July 11th, 2020. And pandemic be damned, the week's sales were 16.6% higher than the week of the same week in 2019. And John Bolton's book also continues to sell, right? We have, anti-racist books from authors Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo that are still posting very strong numbers. All of this is really helping to power a remarkable performance for the industry in the wake of COVID-19, with year-to-date unit sales of print books up 3.6% over last year, according to NPD stats. And if you had told me that this would be the case back in April when this was all just getting started, I'm not sure I would have believed it.
Indeed. And for the publishing industry in the U.S., of course, these numbers do certainly stand out. But as PW also reports this week, the book business elsewhere in the world is finding the going a bit more challenging.
Yeah, indeed. I think U.S. publishers are benefiting from the Trump presidency in this way, where, you know, they haven't in previous years with other presidents. But to paraphrase Macmillan CEO John Sargent back in 2019, I'm sure we'd all happily trade these enormous book sales for, you know, a return to sanity, shall we say. But as you know, my colleague Ed Nwaka reports this week that a new report by the Federation of European Publishers shows that since bookstores closed across much of Europe in March, there's been a, quote, chilling effect on demand. And bookstore sales have dropped anywhere from between 75% and 95% in most countries where a lockdown was put in place. Publisher revenues also have plunged proportionally. For example, overall sales are down 66% in France. These numbers take account for sales between mid-March and mid-April as publishers moved or canceled publications. We've also not had the benefit of book fairs, including book fairs in Bologna and London. And the declines are real. And they come despite, you know, a 52% increase in online sales and also a big jump in ebook sales. In its conclusion, the Federation states that uncertainty remains, but one thing remains certain, that the book sector has suffered a serious blow from the COVID-19 pandemic, the precise dimensions of which are not clear yet.
And in spite of better than expected sales numbers here in the U.S., Barnes & Noble, the nation's largest bookselling chain, has been hit pretty hard by the pandemic, Andrew. PW executive editor Jim Milliot has an interview with Barnes & Noble CEO James Daunt, who spoke about how his tenure began with a baptism by fire, or by virus, really.
You know, listening to him speak, it's hard not to root for James Daunt. And, you know, everyone has been challenged by this pandemic, obviously, in many ways. But James Daunt had a really heavy lift turning around the troubled chain Barnes & Noble before the pandemic hit. And, you know, adding a feather to the weight that he was asked to carry for Barnes & Noble could have crushed most leaders. And he's had a relative refrigerator dropped on him. He took over last September. You know, he tweaked the stores for the holiday season. And then COVID-19 forced all but 24 stores to close in-person shopping. And of course, there's been furloughs and layoffs, terrible stuff. But again, there may be a silver lining in all this. As James Daunt told my boss, Jim Milliot, you know, they were forced to close the majority of Barnes & Noble stores. But while they were closed, he decided to redesign 350 of them. And that's a process that he said he was planning to take up to about 2 years to complete. but it got done with about 7 weeks with no foot traffic. And he says that the effort in remaking these stores has shown that there's sort of a new spirit among Barnes & Noble booksellers. And he believes the bookseller is in a fight that actually can be won, that they can turn this around, that they can improve. Sales have slowly risen each week from the depths that they reached in April. Online sales at barnesandnoble.com have showed steady gains, which he attributes in part to an improved website. And of course, as we just discussed, there's a lot of hot new titles that are bringing customers back into stores. Thank you, Donald Trump. Now, you can read the whole story on the Publishers Weekly site. You get a real sense that James Dond is really deeply engaged in the necessary work of improving the chain's fortunes. And, you know, we're used to being disappointed by Barnes & Noble in recent years. But I can say this much. You really can't be disappointed with what's going on in this climate. And in fact, there's a lot of positives to take away from the work that's now being done at Barnes & Noble.
Next week, the Internet Archive is expected to file its answer to a lawsuit over the archive's book scanning and lending program. That lawsuit was filed in March by four publishers and is supported by the Association of American Publishers. On Wednesday, Andrew, the Internet Archive held an online press conference. You attended and reported on it for PW.
Yeah, so for the most part, it was a 30-minute Zoom press conference. It was pretty low-key. You can read about it on the Publishers Weekly site. My report is up. But, you know, it featured a range of speakers who very briefly explained and tried to defend the practice of controlled digital lending, or, you know, we can call it CDL for short. It's what most people call it. Our listeners may recall that controlled digital lending is the novel legal theory under which the Internet Archive and some libraries around the country on a much smaller basis have scanned and are making available a library. For the Internet Archive, that's a library of about 1.4 million, mostly 20th century print books. So they're scanning and lending the PDFs as if they're print books. And this is a practice which publishers are now suing over in federal court. You know, most of what was discussed at the press conference, I have to say, was not really news. It was a discussion, a very top-level discussion about what controlled digital lending is. And we've covered that before. But it did offer a bit of a glimpse at the shape of the discussion to come, both in court and in the court of public opinion.
All right. So let's take those one at a time, Andrew. How do you see the case going in the court of law?
You know, as the case starts to really get underway, we have an answer is due to be filed by the Internet Archive next week. I have to say, it doesn't look like the Internet Archive is in a very great position legally. Unlike Google, which was, you know, scanning full books, tons of books, these were, you know, books for machines to read, right? For the purpose of indexing and search, and they were all done under strict security. But the scans for the Internet Archive, these are books for people to read. So fundamentally different story. And, you know, I really do have a hard time seeing how a program like this isn't going to be seen as infringing on a commercial right that the authors and publishers hold. Now, you can certainly argue the benefits of the Internet Archive's Open Library program. But I think squaring this with the law is going to be an uphill battle. I just do. And I'll say this, the Internet Archive has put together a superb legal team. But I don't think it's unfair to say that, you know, the Internet Archive is starting this case from very much behind the eight ball.
And in the court of public opinion?
Well, I thought this was very smart. During the press conference, Internet Archive founder Brewster Kahle urged the four major publishers who are suing over the organization's book scanning efforts, that's Hachette, HarperCollins, Wiley, and Penguin Random House, to come to the table and settle the dispute. You know, let's do it in the boardroom and not the courtroom. So, you know, he called on them to help, quote, solve the challenging problems and, you know, drop what he called a needless lawsuit. Now, here's the thing. Brewster's scanning and lending may not square with the law. He may have an uphill battle in the courtroom, but it's not altogether unreasonable as public policy, right? You know, in a press release announcing the suit back in when it was first announced back in June, executives at the Association of American Publishers said the Internet Archive scanning program was not a public service, that it was in fact an attempt to, and I'll quote them here, bludgeon the legal framework that governs copyright investments and transactions in the modern world. And they compared the Internet Archive to the largest known book pirate sites in the world. But that's just not true. I mean, you can look at that and you can try to paint it that way, but that's really not the case. You could try to paint Brewster Kahle as some sort of anti-copyright techno-anarchist, but that's not really going to fly in court. You know, Authors Guild president, you know, Douglas Preston said something similar. He said that what the Internet Archive was doing was no different than heaving a brick through a grocery store window and handing out the food and then congratulating itself for providing a public service. And that's also just, you know, it's ridiculous. That's not really a good comparison at all either. In his brief remarks on Tuesday, though, Kale kind of turned it all around and said, actually, it's not publishers and authors that are being threatened. It's the work of libraries that are under threat in the digital age. And he went on to point out that in the digital realm, the essential role of libraries is being cut out, that they can't fulfill their mission, a mission that, by the way, our society is built on in many ways. You know, they can't buy books and lend them and keep them on their shelves. And, you know, they have to license them. Now, Brewster's vision may exceed the law as it's written. You know, we will see as this case gets underway. But as public policy, I have to be honest, it makes more sense. Brewster's vision of, you know, sort of trying to carry the library vision forward makes more sense than the publisher's vision does. You know, Brewster, with controlled digital lending, is trying to envision a digital world that respects the role of libraries and carries their mission forward. And CDL, whether it's legal or not, is a reasonable attempt to do that. Now, is it actually legal? I don't know. But from a policy perspective, enabling libraries to make scans of the books they've legally bought so that people can access them remotely, especially now in a time of a pandemic, in a way that mimics the way the books circulate in the analog world, like I said, it makes a lot more sense to me than having a handful of large corporate publishers control digital access to knowledge. You know, we've talked a lot on the show in the past about what a mess the digital market is for libraries. You know, many libraries can only license trade ebooks on a temporary basis, right? 2 years or for a designated number of lends, and at prices that often run 3 to 5 times higher than the consumer price. That's no way to build a collection. And many titles, especially titles from a company like Amazon, for example, are not available to libraries at all. But here's the other side of that coin too. Brewster can't do the same thing that the Authors Guild wants to do and just blame the current environment on, say, corporate greed. Authors and publishers have interests that need to be respected here. You know, Brewster Kahle does not automatically get the moral high ground here because he's pushing a library mission, right? And he did push this all forward very quickly and very aggressively. And I understand why to some extent, because the world is changing fast and all these 20th century books moldering on library shelves are at risk of being lost. But Brewster also needs to find a way to bring the publishers, authors, and the public along with him. We all need to be a part of this conversation. And to date, frankly, he hasn't done that. You know, that's a fail. And that's a fail that not only could hurt him now in court, but it could hurt the public as well.
And so what's next in this case, Andrew?
Well, you know, Brewster has asked the publishers to talk. I doubt they're going to agree to talk, but let's hope they do, even if it requires the help of a magistrate judge. And as I mentioned before, the Internet Archive's reply to the publisher's lawsuit is due next week on July 28th, I believe. So we can talk a little bit about that next week. And also at the press conference, Corinne McSherry, who is, you know, she's the legal director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and part of the Internet Archive's legal team. She's basically outlined a little bit of the way the Internet Archive is going to press the case going forward. She said, while she couldn't get into detail, she said that the project serves a classic fair use purpose: public interest, preservation, access, and research. Now, I still think making that case, I look forward to seeing the specifics in their filings, but I still think that case is a heavy lift for the Internet Archive. But one of the things that she said at the press conference that I readily agree with is that the current situation with organizations like the Internet Archive making their rules on one side and major corporate publishers controlling access to knowledge through licenses on the other side, it's not really serving authors. It's not really serving publishers. It certainly doesn't serve the public.
Well, as the Nobel laureate said once, Andrew, you got to serve somebody. And Andrew Albany's PW senior writer serves up the news from book publishing for us every Friday on Beyond the Book. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up next on Beyond the Book, in the midst of political and social upheaval, where do you turn to gain understanding and to foster empathy? For many Americans, the answers are found in books. Reading is a gateway to move beyond misinformation, habits, and prejudices. In June, the Washington Post and the Panorama Project reviewed the lending history of public library systems across the country and developed 9 regional reading lists related to civil rights and race and ethnic relations, reflecting the diverse interests and perspectives of readers in each region. The innovative data search required a creative approach that harvested titles across a range of subject areas, says Gila Charles Gonzalez, project lead at Panorama Project.
Ultimately, we came to develop this project, which was a customized version of Panorama Picks by looking at these books that kept appearing on most recommended reading lists, the ones that had resurfaced on the bestseller lists, because there is no BISAC for anti-racism or anti-racist. It's ultimately a marketing term that's been created to reflect a specific area of interest, but it's not one publishers actually recognize as a publishing category for themselves.
How to be an anti-racist reader and publisher, next on Beyond the Book. Our show is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to Beyond the Book wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Our complete show archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.